revelations of more recent times that he did not live to see, for example, was the ongoing saga, stretched over many years, of the discovery of antimatter. I believe he would have watched one antiparticle after another be discovered. Once again, I believe it would have shown in a story, but again, I don't believe it would have been the spark. I don't believe it would have been the germinal beginning of a story. I believe he got those from places around him and conveniently pulled scientific points, which he understood very well, into them. One interesting thing about Lovecraft is that for all of his tremendous interest in science, by his own statements, that interest tended to stop short of the actual technical involvement. I believe he did not warm up very well to mathematics. I believe the kindest thing I can recall his saying about mathematics is that it filled him with melancholy. However, I have very specific reasons to think that this inclination toward mathematics was much more a matter of temperament than of actual ability. Frequently, when one discusses this sort of thing, of course, Lovecraft made some rather diffident statements about mathematics. I stay away from mathematics. Looking at it gives me headaches, and so forth. Frequently, when criticism is framed around this topic, people look at the story of the dreams in the witch house. Lovecraft there, for example, has his protagonist, Walter Gilman, studying something called that he refers to as non-Euclidean calculus. A couple of interesting critical remarks have been made about that. Robert Weinberg has written out an essay called, pseudomathematics. Pseudomathematics. In which he says that Lovecraft just didn't seem to understand that there's no such thing as non-Euclidean calculus. On the other hand, Sprague de Camp in the biography of Lovecraft said that Lovecraft knew perfectly well that there's no such thing as non-Euclidean calculus, but indulged in that rather common sort of taking of liberty that many fantasy writers do, and used the idea anyway simply because it sounded good. As a mathematician and a Lovecraftian for longer than I can remember, I really have to take exception both with the assertion of Bob Weinberg and the assertion of Sprague de Camp. I must say I disagree respectfully. Respect Bob Weinberg's Lovecraft work very much. The problem really is what the term meant to Lovecraft, and I don't believe we can settle that. As a mathematician, I can assure you that the term is not nonsensical, though. One possible thing is that he may have been referring to a higher dimensional geometry, higher than three. Okay. Now, one does not necessarily deal in fantasy in talking about that sort of thing. In the applied mathematics of the modern sciences, higher dimensional geometric considerations are very common. In fact, in fields like physical chemistry, ideas like infinite dimensional spaces are common parlance. So he very well may have been talking about that sort of thing. In fact, there, I believe, is textual argument in the story of the dreams in the witch house to support that idea. On the other hand, he may have been talking about alternative geometry. So when someone says Euclidean geometry, frequently they mean the sort of classical geometry that has to do with measuring distance between two points by either the Pythagorean theorem or its generalizations. There are alternative geometries, specifically those of Riemann and Lobachevsky, which do not use the parallel postulate and which do not use all, they're not built technically in the same way that classical Euclidean geometry is. Lovecraft, in that same story, does in fact mention, quote, Riemannian equations, which is a way certainly of noticing that he must have been aware of things like that, at least in a non-technical way. It's even conceivable that the term non-Euclidean calculus may refer to things entirely more abstract. I want to try to keep from waxing too esoteric about this sort of thing. I'm aware that generally mathematics is a kind of horror all its own. So you see, I deal with horror both day and night. For example, mathematicians may work with abstract structures. For example, we have a nice little ditty that we call a topological, a locally compact topological group, which is an abstract structure in which you can define an integral of sorts. We call it the Haar integral. And so in a setting like that, which has nothing to do with normal spatial considerations like distance and things like that, you can do a sort of calculus. Now, it's pretty clear that Lovecraft was not familiar with the branches of mathematics that deal with that sort of thing, but whichever of these interpretations you take, it's clear that the term is not nonsensical, and I believe one must conclude that he had some very worthy insights. I really have to take exception with people that take his diffident remarks in certain offhand letters about being having an aversion to mathematics and so forth. That aversion may very well have been real as it applied to the idea of sitting down with a page of equations and solving them. However, on the intuitive level, I think there's every reason to think that he was a very fine thinker. I think he would have gone into the decades that he did not live to see very nicely equipped to understand and to respond to and to use those things which he would have seen. Concerning the point of the germinal source of stories, again, I don't believe that in general, I don't believe a scientific revelation would have started a story. Okay, I believe his reactions to place, I think his sense of place would normally have done that. One place, by the way, let me just mention in connection with the book that I'm doing, that Professor Mozick has mentioned, I was only, let's see, well, it will be 2 weeks ago tomorrow. I was just that recently in a place which Lovecraft calls Cold Spring Glen, which is something you may well recognize if you've read the Dunwich Horror. And only recently, very much thanks to H. Warner Munn, able to identify that definitely as a specific place in western Massachusetts. There is a ravine like that. There is a rock falls. There is a, quote, bear's den. And all of the terminology used there is very, very real. And when one goes down there and looks around, one has no difficulty imagining why and how the place could have affected Lovecraft that way. I find that true in general, in fact, about the places he visited and the places he ended up using as settings for stories. He chose them well. His responses as an artist to those places is perfectly remarkable. You know, we could all go look at those places, as Professor Mozick has said, but who would see in them, you know, the possibilities? Who would end up doing with them what he did? There's one other point. I believe I'm going to save it for my summation and turn things over to Vernon Shea.
Well, our time is getting limited, so I think I shouldn't say too much. Of course, if Bill Lovecraft were living today, which is possible, he'd be in his 80s, but it's possible. But if he were living today, he wouldn't be here. Not because he wouldn't be interested, but for the simple reason he wouldn't have any money to come over here. The heat wouldn't have bothered him at all. He said, wrote me one time that he couldn't understand my talking about it being too hot, because he never had felt the weather too hot. When he went down to Florida, he basked in the sun, and when he visited Barlow, and he thoroughly enjoyed it. And in the wintertime, of course, well, everybody knows that he just couldn't take the wintertime at all. He had any temperature above below 30 was simply too much for him to take, so he had to stay cooped up in the house until the weather got a little bit warmer. But Lovecraft wouldn't have, his finances, I don't think we could have a very rosy picture of his finances, because for the simple reason that all his markets would have been slowly drying up. Weird tales, if he lived into the 50s, weird tales, of course, ceased being published in 1955, and all the other little magazines like Strange Stories just had a few months of existence and sooner or later folded, and The science fiction magazines, of course, were a possible outlet, but on the other hand, the science fiction readers, when they read The Shape of Shadow Out of Time and Color Out of Space and so forth, they were aghast. This isn't the kind of stuff we want to like at all, you know, no action, no... zapping anybody with a zap gun or anything like that, so they just didn't like that sort of stuff. And he would have had a difficulty, I think, getting accepted, maybe gradually. Hamill didn't care too much for his stuff immediately. He might have accepted it for unknown, but as Fritz commented, but I don't think he would have used his hardcore book, his magazines like Astounding and Analog and what have you. So that he would have, financially, he would be really up the creek. If he had only, his mother had left a very small legacy, but I think at the time of Lovecraft's death, it was only about $500 or so, and of course he would have gradually had to use all that up, and his finances were so bad that when he was writing to me, of course, he was living on $5 a week for food, but later, when he was writing to Willis Conover, he had decreased that sum to $2.50 a week. And you can even in the 30s, $2.50 a week doesn't get you very far. He lived on the cheapest stuff possible, like beans and so forth. And that, of course, it was because of what he ate that he got intestinal cancer. If he had been able to eat good nourishing food, he probably would be still living today. But when he was married to Sonia, of course, she fed him as well as possible, and he liked Italian food, so she feed him spaghetti and so forth, so that he was getting astoundingly plump for HPL. He didn't look like the HPL we recognize today at all, but of course his marriage to Sonia didn't last too long, and he went back to his old diet, which of course was abominable, mostly cheese and ice cream. Of course, maybe I should have a personal note, because outside of Fritz, who didn't correspond with him very long, I was the only one who corresponded with him for a number of years. Back in 1923, I'm sure you all remember that date very well, because you were, how old were you then? But anyway, in 1923, I was all of 11 years old, and my father was a magician who was very much interested in fantasy, and any time he saw a new magazine that looked like it might be fantastic, he'd bring it home. So one day he brought home, this is back in 23, a magazine called Weird Tales, and that wasn't the kind of stuff that I liked to read, but naturally, being around the house, I picked it up and read it, and gradually I became very enthusiastic about fantastic stuff, and especially this fellow named H.P. Lovecraft. He sounded like a preacher to me. I mean, he had this solemn air, no humor, right? He sounded like somebody, you know, who, one of these New England preachers, you know. So for years I wanted to write to him, but of course I knew writers just don't correspond to fans, you know. So I never got any nerve up enough to write to him until I was about the old age of 19. So I eventually addressed a letter to him to care of Weird Tales, and I expected that if I got an answer, it all would be just a few lines of acknowledgement. But of course, being HPL, that wouldn't have done him at all. I got the typical HPL letter. It went on for 20 pages on both sides, with that very minute, spirally handwriting that you had a great deal of trouble deciphering until you got used to it. And it was a fascinating letter. He answered every question I had put to him, and in thorough detail. And I'm not the usual brush off that you expect, you know. Oh yes, I'm interested in this and that, but he'd go on for paragraphs about why he was interested in it. And all he was very interested in the fact that I was interested in writing, and of course he always encouraged everybody to write. That most people who corresponded with him had a little no talent, but on the other hand, through the years, he managed to write to a number of people who in later years have become very famous. Fritz was an example, Robert Bloch, August Derleth, Willis Conover, and Frank Belloc Long. Well, Frank was beginning to get established on his own. I can't very well give HBO credit for that, but great many writers were influenced by HBL to the point where they did their own writing. So writing to HBL was quite a pleasure, and I wrote to him, as I said, from 1931, and when I was 19, until his death in 37. And I noticed in the last few months that his letters were getting fewer and fewer. And of course, he'd been complaining for some time about his health, but I'd always been under the impression, which of course is quite erroneous, that he was a hypochondriac. Because why I thought that was because he'd, beginning of the letter, he'd mentioned that he felt terrible, you know, and naturally, if a person feels terrible, he's going to cut the letter as brief as possible, but then he'd go on for about 10 more pages, so you figured that was just a psychological quirk, that he couldn't be ill. But of course, at the last, he was very extremely ill, and nobody really realized it, and I think Conover was the first one who got a real conception that there might be something seriously wrong from his from Mrs. Gamwell. But I always will treasure my correspondence with Lovecraft, and what little writing I have done, which is very little because I've had to work for a living, and if I tried to write for a living, I would have starved long since. I wouldn't be this shape, I would have been HBL shape. So what little writing I have done, of course, was definitely influenced by HBL, and I've written and tried to write a few stories in Lovecraftian manner. Didn't succeed, of course, because nobody but Lovecraft could write like Lovecraft. Some people write better like Lovecraft than others. Of course, Sterlitz couldn't write like Lovecraft at all. He could get the style, but he couldn't get the content. He got to put in starred stones and all these various elder gods who were in conflict with, as Dirk said, with the other ancient ones. And then the ancient ones, of course, and the elder gods were completely indifferent to man. They were, man was just like an ant to them. The man got in their way, they would step on him, but they weren't fighting over the man's souls, because they didn't know whether he had nor care whether man had souls or not. But I think I mentioned my point that Don mentioned about mathematics. I remember in one time that he said that he had just been writing, trying to revise a story by E. Hoffman Price, because he had gone down to New Orleans and met Price, and so Price thought it would be a wonderful idea if they collaborated on the story. And so, of course, HBL was always very obliging, and he agreed to that. But to his horror, when he got the story, he found that it was about two-thirds mathematics, of the kind that the reader would immediately cast aside, because just wasn't interesting. So to revise the story, he must had to cast out practically all the mathematics just to keep a little bit enough in to retain the theme. But I don't think Don, of course, as a mathematician, thinks that HPL was interested in math. I don't know. I think I might argue that point, but who's to say outside of HPL himself? And I don't think he's going to bless us with his presence right now. HBL, of course, today, if we were living today, wouldn't care for the modern day of living at all, because so many things he would have been completely appalled by. Even the younger generation, I don't think, would met with his approval at all, the way they talked, especially, and then lack of manners. You know, even that wouldn't appeal to him at all, because he always was a gentleman through and through, and everybody must be treated with utmost courtesy, and he couldn't see anybody treating another person with disrespect. He would never have been a Harlan Ellison, for instance. Let's see. Well, it's getting fairly late. I think we'd better open the panel to questions from various members.
Thank you, Mr. Shea. What I wanted to do first, before we open it to questions, is to allow each one of the panelists to add maybe a minute or so if they want to comment on what the other ones have said, and then we'll open it for questions. Do you have any further comments, Ms. Yoshi?
Well, I might remark on some of the sources for Lovecraft's political opinions. I have not outlined those very well. If we wish to trace the idea of oligarchy or the aristocracy of intellect as opposed to democracy, we might carry the discussion back to Plato and Aristotle. Plato's advocation of the philosopher king is a very important concept in this respect, although it is interesting to remark that generally Lovecraft did not like either Plato or Aristotle, because in one letter he wrote that these two philosophers had crippled human thought for the next 2,000 years, which I think is perfectly true. But there are ideas in Plato, and more important in Aristotle, the Politics, in which Aristotle says that the best ideal government is oligarchy. And in addition, that government should have restricted voting. Lovecraft postulated in his essay that I mentioned some repetitions on the Times that voting should not be universal. It should be only open to those who could pass certain important tests on politics, civics, ethics, economics, and other important matters actually under discussion in the political arena. Lovecraft did not feel that either some research scientist or some ignoramus would necessarily have any knowledge or knowledge enough to participate in the government. You could be an Albert Einstein and you can be a bum, but you couldn't know what's going on in politics. But I think if you want to trace the actual roots of Lovecraft's political theories, I think you have to go to some of the English philosophers like Hobbes, like Bolingbroke, and these who advocated monarchy, although Lovecraft got away from his monarchical stance and advocated simply, you know, a non-monarchical system which is roughly similar to aristocracy. And I think it's interesting to remark that Lovecraft said around 1935 or so that I never thought about politics or economics until 1930. This is very interesting because before then, he had simply been relying on his literary readings. Perhaps he had found that Alexander Pope had espoused monarchy, therefore he did. But the 1930s, the Depression, I think, triggered a lot of his political thinking. And it opened his eyes to a lot of things because he saw so much incredible devastation. He said that in the Summer Petitions on the Times essay that there were 12 million unemployed at the time of his writing. And this situation couldn't go on. So finally he began thinking and began noticing what was going on and figuring out solutions. And the Summer Petitions on the Times essay actually postulates very, very interestingly some solutions to the economic problems that were facing the country. The solutions which were finally worked out by Roosevelt were not exactly the ones which Lovecraft, but they were in that direction. Lovecraft did not care for welfare as such because he found, or he thought that it might simply descend into the sort of dole that the ancient Romans had practiced. He advocated a division of labor so that each individual would work a part of the day, let us say, and rather than a few working for long periods of time and then many working for nothing at all. This would create not only economic stability, but it would create a psychological uplifting because each individual would feel that he is contributing to society instead of being a burden to it. So I think that the Depression really triggered his economic and political thinking.
Thank you, Mr. Joshi. I would like to add one little comment that I meant to make earlier and it just slipped my mind. Even though this is a science fiction convention, I would like to comment on the notion that Lovecraft's stories were science fiction. I strongly disagree with that. I do not think that he wrote anything that was really a science fiction story. Sure, he used a lot of themes and topics and, for example, extraterrestrial life, etc., which are also found in science fiction stories. But remember that science fiction, if we use a definition of the field, which perhaps is a little bit limited, certainly more limited than the definition that Moskowitz would use, science fiction is the literature of extrapolation to possible futures, alternate realities. In other words, you take current scientific knowledge and you try to figure out how is it going to progress from there. What if this particular invention had occurred or not occurred, etc.? In other words, you have a literature of ideas. The main concern in science fiction is to make you think about the possibilities. In the case of Lovecraft's fiction, you have a very different perspective. It is a literature of moods, of emotions. You're trying to touch the soul rather than stimulate the mind. Since he was not concerned with extrapolating to possible realities or future universes, even though he used some concepts that are common to science fiction stories, the way he used them, the purpose for which he used them, would not allow us to classify him as a science fiction writer. The only possible exception would be In the Walls of Eryx, which of course was originally written by Ken Sterling and revised by Lovecraft. The other comment I would like to make refers to Mr. Shea's comment on Lovecraft being somewhat of a hypochondriac. I have not found the evidence for this. For example, I have a copy of a letter that Lovecraft wrote to Clark Ashton Smith, written on February 5th of 1937, at a time when obviously he was already suffering of intense pain from his intestinal cancer. It's a long letter of something like 10 pages, and in the last paragraph, in the last two lines, he has a comment saying, "I'm feeling a little bit down. I think I have a touch of the gripper." That's the extent of his complaint. A true hypochondriac would have waxed verbose for two pages about all his symptoms and how a doctor's or nothing I do seems to help, etc., etc. So the amount of his complaining, it seems to me, was rather surprisingly little. I certainly would have complained much more if I was dying of cancer. And another thing that has slipped our panel for a moment is a comment on the Lovecraftian films. Mr. Kennedy, who was instrumental in organizing the panel, I suggested that we could speculate on what Lovecraft would have thought of those films they made out of his stories. And I think Mr. Shea is particularly well qualified to comment on those, since he has an interest in films. I personally abhor films. So why don't I skip Mr. Burleson for a moment and let Mr. Shea comment on the films, and then we'll get back to Professor
Burleson. Well, I doubt if any of the so-called Lovecraftian films would have appealed to him. Some of them might have, from the standpoint of atmosphere. I think he probably would have enjoyed the Dunwich Horror, not for Sandra Dee or for Dean Stockwell, who, can you imagine Wilbur Whately being a handsome young man? And when he was supposed to be hiding all his tentacles and so forth under his loosely arranged clothes, but he would have liked the ending of the Dunwich Horror because of using the subjective camera. You see everything through the eyes of Wilbur's alleged brother. Well, he's a brother, but you know what I mean? He was a monster who was going around chewing up all the neighborhood cows and what have you. So, but it was treated very well in that one sequence where the film is shown subjectively, and this for that moment you see the brother. For just in a flash. In fact, I missed it myself. I must have been nodding at the time, but I'm sure it's there because everybody ensures me that it was there. And one film he wouldn't have cared too much for, of course, was The Shuttered Room, for the simple reason that was just shown here, because The Shuttered Room in the first place wasn't a Lovecraftian story. It was merely a so-called Dorothean collaboration, and of course there weren't any Dorothean collaborations, because in all of Durrell's stories, he used only 700 words that were actually written by H.P. Lovecraft. Those were just a mere description in the Lurker at the Threshold. All the other stories were 100% Durrell. He might have used a few ideas from the commonplace book, although even that I'm not too sure about. I'd have to check that thoroughly. But The Shuttered Room is merely a story by August Derleth, so it doesn't belong in a Lovecraftian room at all. And he wouldn't have, it was well acted, I'll grant you, with Oliver Reed and Flora Robeson and Jiglung, Young, and not even Carol Lindley to a certain extent. But I'm sure he wouldn't have appreciated the film, especially if it were supposed to be Lovecraftian. On the other hand, he might have liked The Haunted Palace, which is ironical because for the simple reason that Charles Beaumont, who did the script, hated Lovecraft stories, and did it only for money. He wanted to make a name for himself in a hurry, and how I went in his short Hollywood career, I think in less than 6 years he did more than 32 scripts, and would have done more, but he developed a degeneration of the brain tissue. I'm not sure. I'm not qualified to speak medically, but for the last few years of his life, he was just a vegetable. And so, while he was, his short career lasted, of course, he wrote as much as possible. And he was a competent man. He could, no matter if he hated the stuff, he could still write a good script. And I think The Haunted Palace, despite its title, which was borrowed from Poe, is about as close as Lovecraft as the films have been so far today. Of course, the Die Monster Die has some good atmosphere, but it...